start by saying that, you know, there's this unspoken rule almost. I don't want to say it's a rule. It's an unspoken assumption that whenever somebody's up at the front of the room and speaking to everybody on the other side facing, in the back of the room, or the other side of the room, the other side of the podium at any rate, that somehow or another the person standing behind the podium is in some way an expert and bears some degree of expertise in the field. So let me first completely debunk that. What I'm sharing with you is what I consider in my own life to be probably the most important thing that I perpetually try to work on, and something that is very much a work in progress. And what I'm sharing is not something that I consider myself any sort of expert in or have developed any sort of mastery over, but it's something that I think needs to be kept at the forefront really of all of our minds, and especially in this generation. So I thought it was appropriate to think about what I was thinking about and what I'm going through and what I'm trying to always sort of develop in a capacity of musser and share that as an actual schmooze, number one. And number two, there's a certain measure of poetic justice here, because perhaps even unbeknownst to Rabbi Goldstein, this is something that he has actually helped me out with tremendously in the past in trying to make strides and trying to accomplish in this area a little bit more. And I'll try to cycle back to that when we get there. But I would like to effectively speak about the concept, and this is the way that it's referred to in the self-help literature, the idea of margin. The idea of margin. If you take a look at your paper, hopefully the paper is legible, and hopefully you can tell that we're dealing with different sources, and you probably imagine that we'll be working through the various sources, and you can tell what's the title, and you can tell what's source one and then source two, and you can understand that there's a breakup of different paragraphs and different sentences. And the reason why is because of what we call in the publishing world, not that I'm part of it, but what we call in the publishing world, margin. Margin is critical. Margin is absolutely critical, because without margin, imagine if you took all of the beautiful white space that you don't usually notice even when you look down at a piece of paper, and imagine it just didn't exist. Imagine if the words bled right up to the end of the page, and imagine if everything was just completely squished together. It would be so painful on the eyes that I dare say, after picking up a piece of paper or a book of that nature, you would immediately put it down and say, I'm not going to bother with it, because it's just so overwhelming. And I think that that's a very fair sort of template or mashal even to think about and to consider when we think about our own lives. In the generation, the world in which we live, and this is not just the function of you know, of teenagers or adolescents, we are all part of this, we're all wrapped up in it, we're all bound up in this issue, that white space is increasingly decreasing. That white space is shrinking and is disappearing and dissolving before our very eyes, and in no small part, it's because we're allowing it to, and we're even facilitating it. Just to consider the reality that this is something that the Torah itself places. This is not just from, like, you know, the self-help gurus of this particular generation, but this is something that was recognized even by Chazal, and even in the Torah itself, and even by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and even by Moshe Rabbeinu, as being something that is critical to the way that we live our lives, not just as Jews. I think this is really a universalist kind of concept, but in particular as Jews, that we need to reassert margin in our lives and the ability to create more of that white space. Rashi, in the very, very beginning of Sefer Vayikra and Parshas Vayikra, Uma hayu hafsakos mishamashos. Rashi is dealing with the question of the way that the nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu actually appears in the Torah itself. And why is it that there are gaps? Why is it that there are breaks embedded within the Sefer Torah, within any given prophecy, within any given nevuah? Why doesn't it just roll and roll and run on and run on and run on, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu starts to speak, and he ends at the end of the entire Sefer, Sefer Torah? Uma hayu hafsakos mishamashos. What do the pauses do? Why do we find pauses actually embedded within the very text of the Sefer Torah itself? It's to tell you that this is the way that the nevuah actually functioned. Litein revach lemosha, in order to give Moshe a gap, a pause, a space, margin. Lehis bonein bein parsha leparsha, to consider, to reflect between each and every parsha. Ubein inyan leinyan, between one topic and the next. Kalvachomer lehedyot halomed min hahedyot. And how much more so when we, the hedyotos, right, the regular average Joes, how much more so when we're going about our lives and we're not learning from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's not just immediately beamed into our brains. When we're trying to learn, when we're trying to gather information, when we're trying to glean from life's experiences, how critical it is that there be that hafsaka, that there be that space to be able to pause and to be able to reflect. The Gemara in Shkalim says an amazing thing. Daf Tez Zayin Amid Aleph. Rabbi Pinchas B'Shim Rabbi Shimon Ben Lakish. HaTorah Shenasan LaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe Nitna Lo Eish Levana. It is white fire. Charusa Be'Eish Shechorah. That is then carved into with black fire. It is fire itself. Muvleles be'esh, and it's absorbed in esh, it's absorbed in fire. Chatsuva me'esh, it is hewn from fire. Unasuna me'esh, it was delivered through fire. Dichsiv mimino esh das lamo. Rabbi Pinchas makes an astonishing observation or an astonishing assessment that when we look at the Sefer Torah, it's not just that the words are the fire. The words are what's meaningful. The words is where all the content lies. It is the margin. It's the space. It's black fire on white fire. The parchment. The backdrop. That space. The emptiness that actually creates meaning and allows the content to shine through that is just as critically important as the black fire, as the words themselves. If I have only words, but there is no space around them to be able to distinguish one letter from the next, one word from the next, one sentence from the next, one paragraph from the next, what do I have? Nothing. If tohu vavohu, I have confusion, and I don't have anything that can become relevant enough and can become meaningful enough. It's completely without meaning, and it's one big jumble, and it's one big confusion. I think this may be reflected in the Gemara in Sota as well. The Gemara in Sota says something that we may be familiar with, at least in some capacity or another, even if not in the immediate context that the Gemara places it in. But the Gemara is actually seeking out the reason for which a person might not actually go out to war. And we speak about generally that if a person feels that he has a sin, then therefore he shouldn't march out to battle because whether it means that he'll literally and metaphysically be drawing down or bringing down the rest of the battalion, or it's just that he won't be able to focus, he'll be so encumbered by his thoughts of, oh, I'm such a sinner, and how could I possibly, and God won't protect me, and that attitude is going to prove poisonous within the ranks. What is the sort of sin that we might be talking about? So the Gemara isolates one in particular. Sach bein tefila letefila averihi biyado. What the Gemara chooses to focus on is specifically the idea of speech, the idea of hefsek, the idea of conversation, of saying something between one tefillah and the next, one parts of the tefillin, meaning the tefillin shel yad, and then afterwards when we put on the tefillin shel rosh. Why is it so critical that the two be adjoined and that the two be connected? So oftentimes, at least this is, I would say, a rather standard explanation of this Gemara and tefillin in general, is that we recognize that tefillin are representative of really two different ideas. We place tefillin on our arms because it's representative of action and of doing, and we also place tefillin on our heads because it's representative of thought and consciousness. And the two have to be connected. Right? We can't have one without the other. We need to be able to, we can't just live robotic lives without thought and without meaning, and we also can't just be religious in our minds without it ever leading to practice. So the two have to be connected. I think that the way we would usually think about that and the need for connection, the need of having one and then the other, is slow down. Don't just act. Don't just do. Be conscious. We think about kavana. We think about kavana not only in tefillah, kavana in our actions. We want to have intent in our actions. We want to do, but we want it to be a meaningful do. We don't want to do things blindly. We don't want to do things just because we were told. We want to think and consider, what am I doing right now? I'm about to daven. I'm going to be omed bifnei Hashem. What am I doing right now? I'm going to be sitting in a sukkah. I'm going to be surrounded by a Kaddish Baruch Hu's presence. I'm going to be lighting Neres Chanukah. I'm going to be putting on tefillin, lighting Neres Shabbos. Whatever it is, I want to infuse it with meaning. What's remarkable and what struck me at some point is that in terms of tefillin, it's the other way around. We don't put on the shel rosh that would symbolize thought before the shel yad that symbolizes action. We actually do it in reverse. And perhaps the idea is that we are meant to, yes, think before you do, but also do and then think. I would argue that that is the order and that is the approach that so often gets lost in the shuffle. We know we're supposed to have kavana before we do an action, and sometimes we remember and sometimes we don't. But the idea that I'm supposed to reflect on the action even after I do it? Do we even consider that? Do we even talk about that? We talk a lot about kavanah. A lot about kavanah when you're doing. Do we talk about like the cheshbon hanefesh that comes afterwards? The consideration of what just happened? Was that meaningful? Did I do it well? Let's assess. Could it be more meaningful next time? Could I put a little bit more oomph into it? And I would suggest that today we do that even less. And it's not at all on the agenda. Why? Because what would you do as soon as the action is over? What would you do as soon as you're done, and as soon as you've done the activity, as soon as you've fulfilled the obligation, whatever it may be? Hopefully it's afterwards, but in all likelihood it's actually even during. And you probably didn't even notice that I'm just pantomiming and trying to act upset. You probably thought I'm seriously looking down at my phone while I'm trying to talk to all you fine people. And I'm just multitasking, because that's the terminology that we use in order to speak about somebody as being productive, even though it's rude. There's nothing going on. I'm just acting it out. Because that's how we act. That's what we do. What do we do the moment there's a little bit of space, when I can sit down and I reflect? I'm going from one meeting to the next. I'm getting out of the chasana and I'm driving home. Or lahavdil bin chaim l'chaim, I'm leaving the shiva home right now. What is the first thing that I do? First thing I do is that this gets plugged in and on goes the podcast, and I turn on the radio and I make a call, and as soon as I have the opportunity to distract myself, I do. Why? Because I'm so uncomfortable living in that space. I'm so uncomfortable living inside of that margin and seeing what's going to happen, to sort of get to know myself and get to know my thoughts. I'm almost frightened by it. I can't fall asleep. There's got to be noise on. I can't think. I can't concentrate. There's got to be noise around me. It was a number of years ago. This hasn't happened in years. But at some point, my old shul, we were living in Ohio. At some point, we were a couple of kids fewer at the time. And I think it was maybe even right before like a second birthday. So it was going to be only paying for 3 flights instead of 4 flights, whatever it was. My wife said, I want to go to New York. I want to see my parents. I want to see my family. I said, fine, you know, because not to hate, absolutely, I'm going to stay. I don't want to, you know, use this as vacation time. And there was whatever was going on in the shul. And I remember being in an empty house. And the silence was deafening. I wasn't used to it. Wasn't accustomed to it. So what do? You know, so you put on some music and, you know, you try to fill that space. We are perpetually trying to fill the space. But it's the space that's so critical. It's the space that made Moshe Rabbeinu the greatest Navi of all time, not only because he actually perceived of the Nevuah in the first place in a way that nobody else did, but it made him the greatest Navi of all time because he then reflected on that Nevuah. It changed him. It made him a different person. And his being a different person meant that we could have a different Klal Yisrael, because he could pass it on, and the cup runneth over, so that everybody could enjoy from this national treasure. What do we do to ourselves? We fill the space. And we use these terms. We use these terms like multitasking, as though there is such a thing. We use these terms like no, I'm being productive, gotta go. And we do 1,000 things on the surface so that we don't do a single thing well. And we have 1,000 friends and 1,000 contacts so that perhaps we don't really have a single one. Is it possible to have 1,000 friends? Is it possible to have 500 friends? I think that if somebody were to say that they have 1,000 friends, they might not have a single one. Because that's not what a friend is. So do we give that space? Do we let ourselves breathe a little bit? Do we recognize that by trying to have it all and trying to always do more and another thing and another email and another post and another check and another song and another, that we are wringing ourselves out and that we're suffocating ourselves, as hard as it may be to fight against the culture that we are, I think, very, very much a part of? And yet how critical it is. And I think we find just how critical it is, and almost something of, I think it's odd. I think that this will probably sound like it's coming out of left field, but try to stay with me on this. I think we find a very unusual but very compelling paradigm for just this midah and just this idea if we take a look at the Nazir. The Nazir is kind of like off the agenda right? We don't find too many Nazirim anymore. We don't really think about, boy, I'm sort of like down in the spiritual dumps. What should I do to kickstart? We usually like pick up a praying with fire. We try to listen to a shir. We try to, you know, get to the shul a little bit earlier, whatever it is. Nobody thinks, you know what? I think it's time to take on Nazirus. So it's sort of off the agenda. It's sort of off the table on the one hand. Yet on the other hand, being that the Torah is lenetzach, and it's eternal, and every component and every mitzvah and every dimension needs to be explored, it needs to be mined for depth and meaning. So follow me, if you will, on this adventure. There are, of course, three different tells, three different components to the Nazir. What makes someone a Nazir? What makes someone a Nazir? Let's interact a little bit.
They don't have wine.
Give up wine?
He doesn't shave.
Doesn't shave and doesn't cut his hair. And the third? Tamei Meis. So, what do they have to do with one another? Invariably, this ends up being like a game of which of these things just doesn't belong here. Right, you can kind of make sense of two, and then it becomes very, very difficult to make sense of the third. It's a lifestyle of asceticism. He is recoiling and refraining from physical pleasure, so he's making himself look unkempt and disheveled. He's growing out his hair, and he's also going to refrain from wine, which is the most luxurious of all beverages that one could possibly imbibe and ingest. And he also doesn't go to funerals. Nah, scratch it. Okay, start over. Back to the drawing board. He is a Kohen. It's like a Kohen. The Kohen is not allowed to drink when he performs the Avodah. So he's viewing himself as though he's always engaged in the Avodah. And just like the Kohen can't go to a funeral and can't be Tamei Lameis, so he also won't become a Tamei Lameis. And he also grows his hair out. So it becomes difficult. It becomes difficult. And the Farshim try to loop them all together. And I want to offer I think something of a novel approach. It's not really mine. It's really Rav Hirsch's. And I'm just sort of piggybacking on one comment that he makes, and then I'd like to extend it perhaps to the other prohibitions as well. Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, if you don't regularly look at Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch on Chumash, try to change that. His ability to make meaning out of this, the ostensibly insignificant and innocuous is absolutely remarkable, particularly when it comes to symbolism, and when it comes to iconography of Judaism. Absolutely fascinating. And he writes beautifully. At least the translation in English is beautiful. I make a point, by the way, of trying to davka see Rav Hirsch in English, I think. I'm not much of a linguist, but I think English is probably more closely related to the original German than Hebrew is. And I'm not sure even that the Hebrew is even translated from the original German. I think it might be translated from the English translation. There's a woman in my old shul who actually once remarked to me, his German was exquisite. So I'll share that with you. I have no idea, but so I hear. Anyway, we've already said, he's talking about Nazirus. We have already said that hair, this is wild, think about this, that hair serves to insulate, to reduce receptiveness to external influences. Think about a bear. Think about animals with heavy, shaggy coats of fur. They insulate. They keep you warm. They create an experience by which, irrespective of what's going on in the world around me, makes no difference to me. I'm on my own. I'm independent of the atmosphere and the environment around me. And he then talks about two other instances in which a person actually makes a point specifically of shaving himself. But he says, hence, admission into or devoting oneself to the community while giving up the aspiration to live only for oneself is symbolized by Tiglachas Mitzora and Tiglachas Levim, two instances in which a person specifically needs to connect with society, needs to connect with everything around him, to connect with the host culture and the environment. The case of Levium and the cases of a Mitzvah, I don't want to get into that, but he delves into that and says that's specifically why they make a point of shaving. And the reverse, allowing the hair to grow untrimmed, would then represent self-isolation and withdrawal into oneself. Indeed, that is the task that the Nazir undertakes with his vow for the period of the Nazirus. He seeks to withdraw into himself, to sink into himself. He does not want to detach himself from the world physically. Rather, he wants to work on himself spiritually and morally. He seeks connection with God, with his sanctuary, with his Torah, and with himself. So ostensibly, it sounds very selfish. It sounds very self-centered. It sounds like the Nazir is trying to withdraw from society, and who cares about society, and therefore I'm growing my hair long in order to say that I'm like wrapping myself up in a cocoon almost. I'm on my own. I'm independent, and I'm not going to have the same degree of interaction that I had even just yesterday. On the one hand. On the other hand, what Rav Hirsch notes is that it's not the idea. I'm not just becoming reclusive. I'm not just becoming a hermit for the sake of being a hermit. This is not just extreme introversion for its own sake. I need to withdraw. I must withdraw. Because how am I supposed to be so utterly connected with everything that's going on out there and also find out what's really going on in here? Or what's really going on up there? How can I possibly weigh in and even stop and consider what my relationship is like with HaKadosh Baruch Hu if I'm inundated by those 500 and 1,000 and 1,500 friends and all of the posts and all the things that they share and all of the emails that they send constantly, always? How am I supposed to engage with the relationships that are most critical, at least if I'll be, you know, intellectually I recognize that they're the relationships that are the most critical, if I allow myself during that period and during that time to become swayed and to become distracted by relationships that are really less than critical? My wife once saw, and maybe I shouldn't even admit to it, my wife once saw on Facebook, actually, family that we were friends with posted these gorgeous family photos. It was like, and there was a link, and you can like see all of them, all the ones that they took. And she clicked on it, oh, beautiful, and it was like on a beach, and it was at sunset, and there were the waves and the sand, and it was pristine and beautiful. Everybody looked dressed up so nicely, and you see the whole, all of them, all of the different pictures that were being shown. And in one of them, it was three of the four family members smiling beautifully with the ocean in the back and the sunset, and the father standing behind them like this. And could you imagine? Have you ever been in a restaurant in the past, I don't know, 5-10 years? It's remarkable. You find people who made a point of specifically going out, leaving the house in order to be together so that they could sit across from each other and look down at their screens. It is frightening. So intellectually, I know that the person sitting across from me might be the most important person on the planet to me. And yet, there's something pressing about the buzz in my pocket or the bing on the phone, and I'm compelled to look at the screen. Why? It's because to just live in that space and to just make small talk and just keep the conversation going and allow the conversation to not always go, but just to sort of revel in the fact that I'm just out. We're just here. We're just talking. We're just sharing space, even if we're not talking, even if we're not having any conversation. That's also worthwhile. But we're afraid of it. It's so counterculture now. And because it's counterculture, it's also counter to the way that we act, and it's counter to our own inclinations. I would argue that you could take Rav Hirsch's point and then extend it to the other two prohibitions of Nazirus also. Why is it that you would make a point of refraining from wine? Not just because wine is luxurious, because wine is social. There is no, at least no decent, well, we have sushi here, so that maybe takes the place. But there's no decent social gathering without wine. And when people get together, a cocktail party, can you imagine a cocktail party without wine? Can you imagine a simcha without wine? I mean, even in a halachic context, in a hashkafic context, right? When we have a Sudas Yontif has wine. When it's celebratory, when people are getting together, Sheva Brach is a cup of wine, Kiddush is a cup of wine, benching is a cup of wine, Mevarech al Hakos. Not just because it's exquisite and because it's luxurious, but because it's social. When people get together to celebrate, they drink wine. And the Nazir says, not for me. Not for me. I'm not partying anymore. At least for, you know, for 30 days. I need to withdraw. I need to withdraw. I can't find myself in the capacity that allows for very free-flowing, very easy sort of socialization. I need to withdraw. Why? Not so that I can be reclusive for the rest of my life, but so that after these 30 days are over, maybe after that year is over, then I can come back. Then I can be part of it again. And it'll mean more. It'll mean something. I'll understand what it's all about. I'll be able to contextualize it. I'll be able to say that, you know what, those are the two people at the party that I'm going to talk to. It's not just mingling for the sake of mingling. It's I recognize which relationships are most important, which relationships are frankly just not. And develop and work to craft the ones that are most critical and recognize that we just can't have it all. That if we're friends with 500 people, we're friends with no one. If we're friends with 1,000 people, we don't know what a friend is. Why doesn't he go to a Levaya? Why can't he become Tami Lameis? So maybe this is the most provocative. But because there is no chesed like Chesed Shel Emes. Because the paragon, and therefore the paradigm, of good deed doing is taking care of a mace. Because it's a mace mitzvah, or it's not necessarily a mace mitzvah, but it's chesed shel emes, and chesed shel emes means that I can never be repaid, and it becomes all that chesed is. Chesed is giving to another in the purest sense. Not that I'm going to ever get anything back. In the purest sense, I'm just trying to give to another. And the Nazir says, yes, davka for 30 days, I can't do that. I can't do that. I'm taking a break. Because, and you know, this is much easier to say when you're in somebody else's shul than when you're in your own. Because, yes, you can't be on every committee. You can't do it all. Even the good things. You can't be on every organization. And there are 1,000 good ones. You can't respond to every letter. If I give tzedakah to everyone, then I end up giving tzedakah to no one. And if I spread myself so thin and my time so thin, then how meaningful am I to anyone or to anything? If I'm doing it all, and it's all good, but if I'm doing it all, then am I doing anything? Such an interesting point. Such an interesting point. I may have shared this with the Masivta Chevra at some point. I don't remember. But it was one of these aha moments. It comes from the book Essentialism by Greg McKeown. If anybody's interested, highly recommend it. If you're into like this, you know, all the productivity kind of stuff. He makes a point that only in about the last 80 or 90 years or so has there been such a word in the English language as priorities. Because prior to that, this is going back a while already, but still prior to that, there was only the word priority. It was only singular for the longest time. And then we pluralized it. So much so that now you can sit in on a meeting, whether it's like a board meeting or professional meeting or organizational family meeting, whatever it is, and people, without seeing the irony, can say, these are our 10 priorities. Excuse me? If you have 10 priorities, do you have one? Do you know what a priority is? And I'm not suggesting that we have to narrow the scope and the focus of our entire lives with such tunnel vision that we have but one thing that's really important. But what it suggests is that we're part of a culture and we're part of a society that has a really difficult time recognizing that there are trade-offs. Recognizing that, you know what, if I try to do everything, I just can't do anything. We have a really difficult time with this. I think all the more so because of all the, you know, Baruch Hashem, innovation is progress. But it comes with its challenges, and it comes with its difficulties. Now more than ever, do we get the idea that sometimes there's only but one thing that you can do and you can focus on. I am not doing bedtime if I am also texting a friend. I am not at the park with my kids if I'm also seeing the sports scores. Just not in both of those places at the same time. As an entire society, and we're a part of it. And we're a from society, so we're more insulated, and we're more insular, we're more, there's greater retreat perhaps than maybe in any other component of society, but we're a part of it. And it pushes in on us. And we feel it. Rashi Bamidbar, famous words. Lama nismecha parshas nazir leparshas sota. Why is it that the two come together? We have the Nazirus immediately after sota. Loma lecha shekola roa sota bekilkula yazir atzmo min hayayin. Because anybody who sees what happened to the Esha sota, he's going to refrain from wine. Why? Shehu mevi lidei neyof. Because the wine leads the woman, Esha sota, ultimately to adultery. And I think that the way that any of us, that all of us read this, is that this is the danger of alcohol. Right? It affects and it tarnishes your ability to think clearly and make the right decisions. And people get loose when they're drunk. And I think that everybody reads it this way. And I agree. I think it's true. I think in light of Rav Hirsch, there might be an additional layer of meaning here. That wine and all it represents, and I'm not saying we should stop drinking wine completely, but wine and all that it's representative of, the danger therein is this extreme hyper over-socialization. And if those relationships that we engage in are so fleeting that it's one cocktail party after another, and it's one session of mingling after another, and there's nothing deep and there's nothing significant about any of our relationships, then of course this is what happened. Then of course it all dissolves. Then there's nothing left. And perhaps that's part of what we're meant to recognize, what the Nazir wakes up and recognize. Nor am I saying, by the way, that we should adopt Nazirus. But as a paradigm, as a model for living, recognizing the Nazir's struggle and recognizing what he's doing about it, I think is very, very instructive for the way that we all need to live our lives and make a point of trying to push forward towards, specifically in our generation. I want to skip down, just in the interest of time, but skip down to this second to last source, the Gemara in Bava Basra. It's a well-known Gemara, and it speaks about what exactly one of the roles of the Kruvim was. Why is it that we have the Kruvim on top of the Aron Kodesh? So naturally, we have them on top of the Aron Kodesh because that's how Hashem tells us to fashion the kaporas of the Aron Kodesh. Granted. But they serve another function. It's a barometer. It's a barometer of how we're doing vis-a-vis our relationship with Hashem. L'manda amar p'neim ish el achiv, that they're supposed to be facing one another. The idea that we have two different psukim that seem to describe the manner in which the faces of the kruvim actually were positioned, sort of in two different ways. On the one hand, we say that they're facing out towards the Beis Hamikdash, and on the other hand, we say elsewhere that they're supposed to face towards one another. Why is that? Lo kasha, it's not a question. Kan bizman shi Yisrael osin ritzono shel makom. Here it's where they are performing ritzono shel makom, where we're good with Hashem, where we're doing things for Hashem, where we have a relationship with Hashem. Kan bizman shi ein Yisrael osin ritzono shel makom. And here, in the other instance, where it's pivoted out towards the Beis HaMikdash, they're not looking at each other anymore, they're looking away from one another. How sad? It's because, yeah, how sad? Because there is no more relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What surrounds the Kruvim? What surrounds the Kruvim, the Tzipisa Oso Zahav Tahor Mi Bayas Umichutz Titzapenu, you cover the whole thing with gold, the Asisa Alav Zer Zahav Saviv. A Zer really has two connotations. A Zer is both a crown, and a Zer is also a fence. A Zer is a perimeter. A Zer is a protective border. And a Zer is also where the word Nazir derives its meaning from. A Nazir is a Nazir because he's adorned, he's crowned. I quoted one of the psukim that gives that impression earlier, one of the sources that we skipped over. You can take a look. But that a Nazir adorns himself with a crown of splendor, a crown of spirituality, I'm holy, but it's more than that. He's also adorning himself with a fence. He's placing a fence around his life, saying that if I want to really figure out what is most important, what is most critical, how do relationships really thrive instead of suffer? How do I become a person of depth instead of one who's just completely superficial? How do I know and how do I gauge? How do I protect my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and see that it develops by being a Nazir, by being one who erects a fence? Much the same way that the Kruvim themselves, which are the barometer of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, also have to be surrounded by a fence. Because as much as keeping the good in, the flip side of that is recognizing that there are just certain things that have to be kept out. It's the idea of margin. Margin isn't just one that makes reading a piece of paper easy on the eyes. Margin isn't just something that allows you to, you know, put some notes on the side of your Gemara or flag, you know, an interesting page from an interesting book that you were reading. Margin is something that has to be very much embedded in our lives. The Torah itself is black fire upon white fire because the white fire is no less critical and the white components is no less critical. The parchment itself gives shape, gives meaning, gives context to everything else that takes place. All the other words and all the other messages of the Torah are worthwhile and are meaningful only when there's a chance to pause and to reflect and say that I'm not going to become inundated by having one after the other, after the other, after the other, and sacrifice meaning and sacrifice reflection on the altar of productivity. And I think what the Nazir helps us to do is set up really a paradigm of the way that even if we don't all become Nazirim tonight, and I hope we don't, but even if we don't, provides us with something of a paradigm of what it means to give a check-in every now and again, to recognize that if I am constantly busy, and if I am signed up to the wazoo for all of the wonderful things that one can possibly do to possibly engage in that are all taking place, perhaps there are sacrifices that I'm making all at the same time, even without realizing it. And perhaps those sacrifices, in reality, are too great to actually bear. If we follow the path of the Nazir and we adorn ourselves with a crown, we'll recognize that it's not just so much placing a crown atop our heads and giving ourselves a pat on the back. It's recognizing the importance, the need, and how critical it is to actually erect those fences to ensure that the relationships and the activities and the engagements that are the most critical, the most important to who we are for our life's mission are very well protected. Thank you very, very much for listening. Thank you, everybody, for turning out on a kind of a scary night out there. And all the best. Yashar Koach.